Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. We are an associate of CCPN, which you can find at www.thecommonprojectnetwork.com.
Talking about a revolution sound. Don't you know? Talking about a revolution sound. While they're standing in the welfare line, crying at the doorsteps of the armies of salvation.
And we are talking revolution tonight with Julio Pino. Hello, Julio.
How are you doing?
It's good to have you here. Revolution is one of your favorite topics, I think. Am I right?
Yes, it is true. I both learn and teach it.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, you're even teaching at that. I like. Now, you're originally from Cuba.
That's right, yes.
Do you want to just give us a little bit of background on that and how you came to be here? You live in Ohio now, so you're practically.
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
So, pardon me, say that again.
No, I said you're practically my neighbor because I'm in Illinois, so we're close.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, Cubans in the Midwest are kind of a rare combination, but they do exist. Oh. Well, anyway, I was born in Havana, but I was actually raised in a small island off the coast of Cuba, which back then was the Isle of Pines and now the Isle of Youth. And I stayed in Cuba until almost 8 years old. So I went to the primary school system and such. And then my father and mother decided to emigrate. I was their only child then in 1968. And we moved to Los Angeles rather than Miami because my father's aunt lived in Los Angeles. So, you know, again, it's strange, but I've never really lived in a Cuban-American community, whether in Miami or New York or any place else, but places where there are scattered numbers of Cubans. And, yeah, ever since then, 68, I've stayed in the U.S. I mean, I've traveled around the world, but the one place I haven't been back to is Cuba, the big bureaucratic hassle. But I do study it, and as I incorporate it into my classes, teach it, and keep up with what's going on there, both for personal as well as for political reasons.
Right. Well, yeah, that is sort of unusual, because I was going to ask you about the Miami community, because we always hear that there's a big, active Cuban community in Miami. And
yes.
The closest I've got to that particular community was eating in some of the wonderful restaurants. And so, I mean, it's like, I like it. But,
So why?
Yeah, well, see, you bypassed then that. And like you said, you've never lived in a truly Cuban-American community. I think that's probably
no.
On you, I would think. But now, what do you teach in Ohio?
I teach two things. I teach world civilization, which is basically world history, and then my own specialized area, which is modern Latin America, focusing mostly on Cuba and Brazil. Yes.
Right. What about, mostly Cuba and Brazil. Do you ever get much into Venezuela?
Yes, as a matter of fact, just by coincidence, starting next week, I'm going to have my students do a comparison between the Cuban Revolution and the so-called pink revolutions that are going on in South America right now, Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador. So, yes, I've taught that, you know, Hugo Chavez's revolution, Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela, and I'll be teaching it again starting next week.
Excellent. Are your students quite receptive to this?
Yes. I'm going to put it another way. Obviously, in the Midwest, it's harder to teach than, say, when I was living in Los Angeles there's not the connection, the familiarity. I can't make references to, you know, the Mexican border, things like that. But on the other hand, you know, we do get some news filtered through this or that media. So they're not totally unprepared or unfamiliar with the material. So, you know, it takes time for them to become receptive, put it that way. But we do have some lively discussions in the class over issues such as human rights, versus protecting the revolution and what happens as Castro took over. So I think so far I've had some very good discussions and gotten all sorts of points of views from all kinds of students. So I'm very happy with the way things have gone.
Yeah. Well, I could see that the Midwest would not maybe be what you would immediately think of as a ripe area for certain topics.
Right.
I have traveled a lot, but I did grow up in the Midwest, and so it's its own thing. I mean, as every place is. So you actually, I don't know now, how would you describe your own political philosophy? If you were to say, okay, I'm this or I'm that, where would you fit?
It's evolved over time, obviously. When I first came to the United States, I suppose I shared, I don't think of the same extreme, but I shared many of the very, you know, conservative views of most Cuban Americans, including with regards to Cuba or towards Cuba. But as I began to study it more and more, and not just in terms of Cuban history, but looking at things that were going on as I was growing up, such as the Vietnam War, for instance, or uprisings in other places such as Africa, my views began to change. They became much more, sympathetic towards the Cuban Revolution. And so where I am today politically, I don't really, affiliate with this or that political party or faction. It's just that I try to remain independent. But on the whole, I still see the necessity for revolution in Latin America, indeed, throughout the world, if you want to include the United States. But like I said, my views have evolved and hopefully will always keep evolving. I think remaining static on any question, whether it be Cuba or the Middle East or any place else, is just dooming yourself into dogma.
Yeah, well, the dogma equals stagnation pretty much. I think. But so now we know since the revolution in Cuba, the Castros have been at the head of the party of the country, and you believe it's time for them to bow out?
Yes, I do.
Or step down?
You put it that way, exactly. It's been, 54 years since Fidel Castro entered Havana on January 1st, 1959. Mm-hmm. Due to ill health, he gave up power, or at least gave up the presidency in 2006, and then his brother Raul took over. How much influence Fidel Castro still has over the Cuban government is something that's very debatable. No one is sure. But the two of them together make policy, and really nothing is done in Cuba without either they suggesting it or, you know, vetting it in some way. So there's still a monopoly, essentially, of power, not only just in one party, but you could put it in blunt terms, in one family. I think that's starting to change. Raul Castro has designated a successor who was not from the family and who was actually born after the revolution. So that's a good sign. He's also declared that, including himself, presidents of Cuba will now be subject to term limits. But yes, you know, hopefully if he abides by that promise, perhaps even within his own lifetime, Cuba will see a president who is somehow more representative of the will of the people than opposed to just, you know, one family.
Yeah, because even, I mean, it's just that monopoly sometimes, I mean, it may be necessary occasionally, but after a while, there again, it starts to stagnate, and we need new blood, so new ideas and different ways of implementing them. So see that. I mean, I've always, I shouldn't say always, but yeah, I've had a thing for Fidel Castro for years and years and years. Just, I think it had a lot to do with the revolution and everything, and I thought that he really cared at a time when nobody did, and what the United States tried to do and has done all this time with this embargo has just been ridiculous, in my opinion. And so, go ahead.
Yes, what I was going to say is not only is it ridiculous, it's counterproductive.
Yes.
It helps, exactly. It on both sides, on the U.S. side, you know, it makes the U.S. look ridiculous before the rest of the world. And on the Cuban side, pardon me?
Well, the U.S. looks ridiculous in the eyes of the world.
Anyway, good point, exactly. But yeah, on the Cuban side, obviously, it's also a good excuse for stagnation, because any change inside of Cuba is automatically, you know, designated by the regime as being problematical at best and downright dangerous at worst, because the U.S. is likely to take advantage of it. So a relaxation of those tensions would be helpful on both sides, but I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, unfortunately.
Yeah, unfortunately. I mean, that, because it is, that is so outdated. I mean, I understand way back when the United States put the embargo on, if they had to, I could still sort of see why they thought they had to. But that was over long, long, long ago. And
for it.
You know, and so many other countries are, you know, the United States is actually, well, since it's run by corporations that love money, they're missing out unless, you know, so many other countries are doing things like for the tourist business and everything in Cuba. And
absolutely.
So the United States, well, the corporations, we know they're like multinational, so I guess they're still getting their money. But as far as just regular citizens like me, it's hard to try to get into Cuba. I mean, you have to do a lot of stuff, and I think that's ridiculous. We're only what, 90 miles away.
That's right.
And to be for 54 years, it just makes no sense whatsoever to be treating Cuba like, you know, the dreadful stepchild or whatever, or not even that, just like the enemy.
Right. It's like the person who makes a giant mistake, but then if you try to correct it, you know, it's like telling the world, oops, you know, I made a big flop way 54 years ago, so I can't correct it. So, yeah, and it's also like a game of chicken, you know, you have to go first, no, you do.
Yeah.
So, It's more about the symbolism of the embargo than the embargo itself that keeps it alive.
Yeah. Well, it is childish, no matter what anybody says. It's just childish. And I have been very impressed with a lot about Cuba. I know that during Katrina, that hurricane that hit New Orleans, Cuba offered, I believe it was 500 doctors.
I think that was the figure.
Yeah, and the United States turned them down. I thought, you know, that's one of those cut your nose off to spite your face, you complete idiots. We needed so much help because FEMA totally didn't. And,
right.
You know, but yet the United States, instead of saying, yes, thank you, please, they were, well, no, we don't need your help. We don't want it. You know, things like that. And Cuba sends people, they send doctors and teachers around the world to help.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're right. It's the one exception that I've heard of is that Cuban medical schools do accept students from the United States. So there are some there, some African-Americans, some Latinos, but that's the exception. And they go back to their home communities in the U.S. But yeah, whenever there's a natural disaster anywhere in the world, literally from Pakistan to Venezuela, the Cubans have always offered free of charge aid in the form usually of, again, so much money as people.
Right. I mean, like good qualified people. And other countries have been smart enough to utilize that help.
Yes.
But there again, the United States has not done so. Well, like you said, it's very hard for some people or some countries, some governments to say, man, we screwed up. You know, we screwed up way back then, and we're sorry, and we're going to make that right as we can now. They want to not do that. But what do you think? Now, you're not in the Miami community or the L.A. community. I don't know if L.A. has anything like the Miami community?
It's not a community in the sense of, in the same way as Miami, as it is an enclave where people, you know, trade with each other and see each other every day. What you have in Los Angeles essentially is like clusters of Cubans here and there. So I grew up there. I spent the first 20 years of my life in the U.S. In Los Angeles. And you literally have to travel quite a long distance to find other Cubans. In that sense, the two are not comparable.
So that was not in L.A. I guess, does New York have a Cuban community as such?
A community, again, no. There are clusters here and there. Yeah, it's funny because I travel to New York maybe once or twice a year. And, yeah, the Cubans there are literally hard to find. You have to go to, like, a restaurant or something like that. Yeah. And even sometimes there's a staff is in Cuban. But, no. New Jersey, yes, oddly enough, is the second largest Cuban community in the U.S.
Really?
After Florida. Yes.
Oh, I
haven't been there. Yes.
Oh, New Jersey. Well,
New Jersey, especially around Union City.
Well, I guess that would be because, well, you know, we think of New Jersey being close to New York, so maybe the people who went in the area, then they settle in New Jersey. And
That's what I figured, yes.
Well, now, at one time, the Cuban community in Miami was very anti-Castro. Is that still the case?
Yes, it is. But what's changed over time are the tactics in dealing with Cuba. So if you're talking about anti-Castro in the sense of would they want to see him removed from power, even if it took something like a U.S. invasion to do it, that hard line is still there. But on the other hand, with regards to tactics, that is in dealing with Cuba, you find less and less support every year, for instance, with something like the embargo. And it's interesting, strangely enough, well, you know, go figure given diplomacy, many Cuban Americans were very upset with the second Bush administration because it placed upon Cuba even further, shall we say, embargo-like legislation, in other words, to punish Cuba economically. Mm-hmm. And it made it harder for Cuban Americans to return and to go visit the island. Also made it harder for academics such as myself to go back. So even though the Cuban American community in Miami usually votes Republican, actually that second Bush administration made them very, very angry. So, there's two things going on here at the same time. Like I said, on the one hand, if you talk about things like the embargo and going back to Cuba, I mean, by Cuban Americans, and sending money and making contact by phone and so on, the Cuban Americans in Miami are not isolationists. In a sense, they would want more exchange between Florida and Cuba. But on the other hand, if you ask them how they feel about the Castro regime, know that anti-Castro, anti-communist hostility is still there. It's literally become a generational question. You would have to die for the generation that came over, from 59 to basically 62, 63, for the generation to die out, and another generation that has no memories of pre-Castro Cuba to take its place before you saw a significant shift in Miami Cuban opinion towards Cuba.
Okay. I think that happens around the world, actually, in many different situations. Sometimes the older generation has to, if not die out, at least become very much less.
Get out of the way.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you what's different about the Cuban case. Chinese Americans, for instance, invest heavily in mainland China and communist China. The Taiwanese. Mm-hmm. Vietnamese Americans, I grew up among them too in Southern California, don't have any problem investing in communist Vietnam. Some of them actually have moved back to set up shops there. The Cubans in that regard are different. The history is different. The proximity of their enemy, perceived enemy, is different. The embargo, the fact that the two countries have no diplomatic relations. So certainly generations play a role, but so do other factors that come into play that makes the Cuban Americans much more hostile to the land that they left behind, as opposed to, again, the Chinese, the Vietnamese, and so forth.
Yeah. That makes sense, definitely. Because, the real hard line, to me, is just sort of scary. And that's what I've always heard about the community in Miami, that they're very much against. I mean, that they would, just welcome, like, the United States to run over the country. And
oh, yeah.
it's like, oh, how horrible, you know, in my opinion.
It is. As a matter of fact, I remember this very well. When the U.S. invaded Iraq, there were actually prominent Cuban-American politicians who seriously suggested do the same thing to Cuba.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, if you're going to liberate Iraq from Saddam Hussein, do the same thing and get rid of Fidel Castro for us.
Oh, my God. Those people, we have fanatics everywhere in every country and every political party. But that to me is just totally crazy. But now, you're saying that they're against communism. What about the younger group coming up? Do you think that they understand that capitalism is dead and that something else has to take the place?
If you're talking about the young Miami Cubans, the answer is no. They're a very highly educated group. Most of them are middle class.
Mm.
And so they, you know, again, if you compare it to other Hispanic groups in this country, they haven't had the same experience. Whether you're talking about, you know, racism, prejudice. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. It does. It doesn't exist to the same extent. You don't have a very high level of, say, Cuban-American unemployment that's comparable to, say, Chicano or Puerto Rican or Native American mixed with Hispanic. But you get the idea. It is a Hispanic group and it's a Latino group, yes, but it doesn't share the same experiences as others. So, no, their view of capitalism, you know, they're critical of this and that. And it's interesting that you've had over the years a shift. Not over 50%, but maybe closer to like 40% of that younger generation now votes Democrat as opposed to, you know, hardline Republicans as they all used to be. But if you're talking about the way that they view this country and its institutions and its economic institutions, it's a really favorable view, not only because of what they heard from their parents about Cuba, what they see on the nightly news, but because they've done very well in this country.
Okay. Okay, and as long as they're watching the nightly news, it's mainstream media, they're probably going to keep those views if they don't.
Absolutely, because there's only one side that's being presented, especially on Miami television.
Yeah, so that's in my opinion rather sad. What do you now? You were talking about other countries that we would say like South American or Central American countries. What is going on there? I know some of the countries have been doing lots of demonstrations and things because of the corporations that are trying to do what I believe it's either in Bolivia or Ecuador. I'm so sorry, I don't the big dam that they're going
to Ecuador.
Yeah. Things like that. They're protesting against the corporations that are going to really destroy villages and livelihoods and everything. How is that coming? What's going on?
It's very complicated because even when you have leftist regimes such as in Venezuela, in Ecuador, and Bolivia, they're not anti-capitalist per se. They're more like, shall we say, to use American political parlance, anti-corporatist. So while they do protest things such as what you mentioned, you know, building a dam that's going to destroy the environment and the indigenous group that lives there, or in the case of Venezuela, they're constantly protesting, and rightly so, over American interference in their internal political affairs. The other side of that, again, is that these are not regimes like that of Cuba that are dedicated to the elimination of private property. So they're, shall we say, more anti-capitalist excess or anti-interventionist, but, you know, are they in the same camp and the same field as Cuba? No, they're not. And popular mobilization in these countries tends to be around, again, very specific issues such as, you know, destruction of the environment, indigenous rights, national sovereignty, but it's not, you know, let's change one economic system for another. I wouldn't go that far. It's not the kind of systematic call that Fidel Castro was making back in 59 and the 60s of, you know, all Latin America must go socialist or move in another direction. It's much more complicated than that.
Okay. Right. Well, as time has gone on and the population has increased and everything, it gets more complicated. More fingers are in the pie and more the multinational corporations are. When you teach about world civilizations, Is that course, I mean, way, way back, or is it more current?
No, it's recent. So basically, I start with something like the Conquest of the Americas, 1500 or so, and move it up to the present day.
That has to be interesting, because I somehow have a feeling that you're actually teaching the truth, which a lot of us in this country didn't learn when we were in school. I really don't fault our teachers. They taught what they thought was true, but
right.
So much left out and twisted that, you know, we had to relearn it. So what
you're absolutely right. Even the textbooks that I use, because you only have a certain number that you can choose from, give very short spaced to Latin America. And when they discuss things like American intervention in, you know, Central America and Cuba, obviously, and so on, they still do so in a very pro-American light. So, you know, I try to give the students a very balanced view, looking at, you know, Latin American voices, memoirs from the region, and so on. But it's very difficult to get through, you know, things like the mainstream media or even just high school or even college textbooks, which teach only the American version of Latin American history.
Right, right. That's got to be quite a problem, because, like you said, it's the American point of view, and the American alphabet agencies like the CIA and a few others were the ones who were down there stirring up so much trouble, assassinating leaders, so they could put in somebody who was more favorable to the United States. They did all that, and that's not really going to show up in the history books you're teaching from.
No. Usually to do that, I have to show the students a documentary or a fictional film that deals with, you know, say, like Missing, for instance, for Chile. But, right, and especially, of course, you get a generation that was born after 1990 or 95. So, you know, to them, Fidel Castro is basically like a dinosaur figure. And they never heard of things like the CIA overthrowing Allende in Chile, which we commemorated the 40th anniversary of just last week.
Right on September
1973.
So, do they, when they see this, do they get it? Have you ever had a complaint from a parent? Let me ask you that you were teaching?
No, I haven't. At least not to my face. You know, sometimes people might complain to the university, and then it stays at a higher level. No one has ever come to me and said that I'm, you know, teaching in a partisan manner. No. Like I said, I try to present both sides, why the U.S. would feel compelled to do this or that, like overthrow Allende or sponsor military dictatorships in Central America. And then the opposite point of view, which is why would people take up revolution in Latin America?
Yeah. So, well, that's good. Yeah. And so the university has never censored you or chastised you or anything. So,
no, certainly not. No.
Yeah, that would not be a good thing. Are there any kind of, clubs or organizations or anything there at the university for people who may be of a left bent that you are affiliated with?
No, I'm not. And it's interesting that as we're talking about Kent State, people always assume that it must be some kind of leftist or radical place, and it's not. We've had left groups come and go on campus. I don't think actually there's anyone that's registered now, except maybe the Democratic Socialists of America. But no, I'm not affiliated with any on-campus group.
Is that just because you're not really interested in those, or you think that being a professor there, that wouldn't be a good idea, or what would be the reason?
I think it's a combination of both. On the one hand, the politics that these groups present don't appeal to me. And on the other hand, yes, it's very problematical when you have to sort of wear two hats as professor and then as political activist. So I am politically active on campus, but in an independent manner, not as a spokesman for this or that faction or party or organization.
Okay, so what do you yourself do there? I mean, since you're not the spokesperson for a certain organization.
Right. Well, what I try to do, again, you know, we're talking here about outside the classroom life and outside of my professional duties, is to, try to present what isn't being presented by the mainstream media. For instance, I was very active, as we talked about the Iraq War, I was very active in, on campus and trying to, you know, get, shall we say, mobilize people against it. Not that I was alone, obviously, but I was out there, you know, leafleting and talking to people and speaking at on campus forums. So in that capacity, you know, as an independent, if you will, I've tried to do whatever I can. I guess in a nice sense of the word propaganda, to alert people as to what their government in their name is doing in places such as Iraq.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean that. Okay. So you're very active, even though you haven't put yourself in with any particular organization. And have you been not from the parents or the school? Have you ever had any kind of negative reactions from people when you are leafleting and talking? I mean, some people get by and they seem not to have a bad experience, but others have, you know, had some negative.
Right. It depends on the issue, obviously. When it comes to things like the Middle East, for instance, it's such a hot and polarizing topic. Yeah, I've gotten it from both sides. I've gotten people who have supported me. I've gotten people who are very hostile. So, you know, but you have to take it with a shrug and just move on.
Well, sure. It's one of those ways that if you don't have a thick skin when you start, along the way you must develop one just for your own
sake. Precisely. Yeah, we've all learned that the hard way.
Yeah, that's I think that's true. What do you see for the U.S. coming down the pipes? Because so many people are so unhappy, and now we're just celebrating Occupy, the 2 years since Occupy started. And, you know,
right.
A lot of people have said that, oh, Occupy was a bust, it proved nothing. And others, and I'm one of them, I think that it really was a good thing. It let people know that they weren't alone. And out of Occupy has come some people who I see as future leaders of movements. So, I mean, I'm a pro-Occupy person, but what do you think now? Because Occupy has morphed into something different. It seems like it's more on the local level. People are doing things for their own community, whether it's for the homeless or women and children, whatever. So, What do you think of Occupy?
I tend to agree with your opinion. I think it was a very, you know, favorable moment. I don't like to use jargon, but you call it a teaching moment for Americans. So in that regard, you know, it essentially came out of the blue and told Americans, you know, about the inequality in this country, about the homelessness. Like I said, I get into New York frequently, so it's strange because I was there sort of like at the embryonic stage of Occupy, and then back about 6 months later, I sort of caught up to the entail of it. So I wasn't in the thick of things, but I was there for a while and, you know, observing what was going on from here. There was actually an attempt to start an Occupy tent, but it never got off the ground. If you're looking at Occupy as a kind of clarion call, and I agree with you, it was a momentous event, which probably hadn't happened in the U.S. since the 1970s, certainly, in, you know, trying to, and successfully, in my opinion, trying to shift public opinion away from, you know, what's going on in Washington as opposed to what we can do about what's going on in this country. But when I talked to people who were in Occupy Wall Street, I was telling them that, you know, at least as from my point of view as both a person who's been political pretty much all of my life as well as a historian, that unless you build up some kind of structure, not a party, not an organization, but some kind of structure, that, you know, what you were going to get out of it is exactly what you said, you know, essentially minuscule groups here and there working on small issues. And that's great, but a lot of these small issues don't have small problems, whether you're talking about, well, homelessness isn't a small issue, it's a big issue. You can certainly tackle it on the local scene, but unless you change the way in which this country is essentially run politically, then, you know, whatever small gain you make is essentially going to be pushed back. So, for instance, every time there's a change to the electoral laws, you know, to get big money out of elections.
Yeah.
There might be this or that law passed, but then, you know, the corporations find always some way to get around it. And we still basically just have two political parties, both of which are essentially full property parties. So again, I was as impressed as you were by Occupy Wall Street. I still am. I know people who are, you know, veterans, for lack of a better word. I get in touch with them. But I do wish that something more structured had come out of it, as opposed to simply, you know, a legacy of protest, but now reduced to, as you say, you know, more small-scale affairs.
Yeah, it has such potential, and it just has morphed. So I don't know. I do believe, though, that we have some leaders coming out of it. But you mentioned the two parties. I just call them the uniparty because I don't see that much difference. And I think it's about as crooked as anything could be. But that's because, you know, totally bought off. I believe our president was selected, not elected. And I think a lot of officials that's the case. So I can't see how, now, like you say, we need to get the money out. And with the people who are in office now, I don't know how we're going to do that because obviously they're recipients of the money.
Yeah, so, both sides.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not, when people start, you know, saying things about the Republican Party or the Democrat Party, and it's just like, I'm, you know, come on, people, it's the same party. They may
it
have
is.
Those, but yeah. We're talking uniparty here, and that's what, in my opinion, has got to come down somehow.
I quite agree. Yes, that's why I'm in favor of independent political action outside of the two political parties.
Yeah.
It's funny because I used to know people, and some of them personally, some of them by correspondent, I mean faculty people, you know, people in my profession, who in a strange sort of way have become, I don't want to say cynical, but the fact is that when they see the two parties, on one level they agree with you and with me that, yeah, there's no basic difference between the two, but then they make the argument of, you know, but one is obviously more evil than the other, therefore you have to choose one over the other.
Yes, the lesser of the two evils. There is no lesser of the two evils, in my opinion.
No, there isn't.
It's one evil.
No. Exactly. And if I had to drive one point home tonight, or I try to drive home, you know, this point, when I do politicking, it's exactly that. So long as you work for one of the other, the two parties, regardless of, you know, which one you think is the lesser evil, you're just perpetuating a system that brought us nothing but corruption, wars, inequality. So, you know, in a sense, reforming the system is strengthening the system.
Yes. Yes.
You know.
That's what I tell people about third parties. I said, okay, we don't have the money. I mean, nobody's trying to buy us off. But if you're going to vote, and I don't say don't vote, but I say vote third party as much as you possibly can, because that shows that you do care and you will vote, which the powers that be don't want you to care. They don't want you to vote. They want you to be dumbing down.
Right.
So by voting, you're showing you care. And by voting in third party, you're showing you're not supporting them. So,
yep.
No, that's my take on that. I wanted to mention I'm talking with Julio Pino, and he can be found on Facebook. That's Julio and Pino, professor in Ohio and pro-revolution. I say that, and then I'm going to ask you, do you see down the road in the United States some kind of real revolution?
Yes, I do, because we're living in an empire. Pardon me?
I said, yay, yes, yes. Go
yeah,
ahead.
That's how I see how you're giving a yay or a thumbs up. Exactly.
Yes,
I do. And the reason why is that we're living in an empire in decline. The obvious example of this is, you know, the Broglio, and actually the kind of almost, if it weren't tragic, it would be funny, slapstick that happened over Syria. When it used to be that the president of the United States, you know, for evil reasons, could just snap his fingers and bomb a country. You know, Nixon did it to Cambodia, LBJ did it to North Vietnam, Bush the first invaded Panama. But Obama couldn't sell this bill of goods even to the U.S. Congress, much less to the U.S. public, which shows you that, you know, people are starting to wake up. They may not be ready for a revolution. They're not, put it bluntly. No. But they do recognize that the United States is in a far, far worse position in every sense, economically, politically, even in its legitimacy in the world, than it was when, you know, Obama took office. Again, I've had my disagreements with this over with other academics and people that I meet in politics, of where I was telling them, you know, he was essentially brought in to clean up the mess that was left behind by his predecessor.
And he made it worse.
You know, the empire of fresh face. And, you know, at first it seemed like he might be succeeding, but on every issue that you and I could talk about, whether it be, again, you know, Israel or Venezuela or Cuba, he's either as bad or in some cases even worse than Bush was.
Yeah. That is just so bizarre. I mean, I was not taken in by his lies, even though I'm from Illinois and people say, well, you're from Illinois, you had to know and like Obama. And it's like, well, no, I didn't. I knew he was what he is. But I heard someone from, well, his name's Alan Mackey from Minnesota. He's an activist there, and he is on Stuart Alexander's show here on this station called The Socialist Insight. And he comes on every couple weeks, and what he said, and I cried. You're talking about people actually realizing they didn't want to get into Syria. He said that even little towns in Minnesota, people had banners out over the expressways and things when you would go, saying "Stay out of Syria, no war," this kind of thing. And we haven't seen that for a long time.
No.
I was very, that really moved me, because it's like, okay, middle America seems to be starting to get it. At least some people are. And no, people don't want any more war. We know, like you said, things are much worse than when Obama took office. And, you know, we can't feed our own people. We've got one out of every four children in this country going to bed hungry. That is just disgraceful. And yet we have all this money to go kill people, to kill other people's children. Now, there's something really, really wrong there.
Absolutely. Yeah, and obviously the fix has to be more than political. It has to be moral as well. But, you know, when you run an empire, morality is not a priority for you.
No.
We're keeping it glued together.
Yeah, and we know that, like, okay, the corporations, multinational corporations, run the world, and corporations' first mission is to make a profit. So war is big business.
Oh, yeah.
Big money. And so as long as we have these multi-corporations and feed into them, you know, we're going to have the wars.
Absolutely. Exactly. It's what Naomi Wolf has dubbed disaster capitalism. First, you destroy the place, then you bring in corporations like Halliburton to clean up the place.
Right.
And the government and these corporations working together essentially, you know, make billions, which they then pass off to pay for the U.S. taxpayer to get bail them out to pay for it.
Right. I mean, there's something so convoluted about that. I do think we're going to have a revolution in this country, and I can't put any kind of date on it or anything. And I, along with some of my friends, think that there will be blood in the streets, which a lot of people don't want to hear, and they think that it will be a nonviolent takeover, a nonviolent revolution. What do you, because you're much more studied in this than I am, what do you think, Julio?
I don't think we should lay out scenarios, first of all, because, again, you get into that trap of dogma of saying, been there, got the T-shirt, I've been in political groups here and there who actually had that position of the American Revolution is going to come down this way, X, Y, and Z. So I don't know if it'll be bloodless or bloody. I couldn't say. What I do say is this. The history of this country essentially tells you that the American people can be mobilized in large numbers, such as, for instance, the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement. Even up until the time of, you know, the two Iraq wars, we had demonstrations in D.C. and New York City for hundreds of thousands of people. So you all mentioned, obviously, Occupy Wall Street. So I see a revolution coming. I would hope that it would be in that spirit of, you know, people essentially coming out and saying, you know, enough, we're not going to do this anymore. We need a whole new system of government. We need a whole new system of economics. I would hope that it would go down that way. But again, without making predictions, given the record of the kind of people who run this country and how they run it, and again, it's not a country, it's an empire, are they going to, you know, just give up power because tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people come out in the streets and demand it? Probably not. So, again, without making predictions, without advocating a particular road to follow, I do see some kind of confrontation coming down, probably sooner rather than later.
And I did want to make a point that I left out when I said that about blood in the streets. That would have been being started by the government, not the people, but
right, true.
That the government wouldn't like what the people were doing, and so they would start the violence.
Sort of
Occupy in New York when the police attacked and the man started pepper spraying and. That was horrible, but the thing was, that really got attention. That caught people's eyes. That the cop
true.
Was, you know. And so sometimes you have to have the bad actions on their part to get people to set up and take notice.
Unfortunately, that's true. Yes, there's going to, you know, some heavy repression is going to come down. And, you know, Occupy Wall Street was largely peaceful. In fact, all peaceful, as far as I know. And yet, look at the way the police and the government or the feds reacted.
Actually, very, it was disgraceful. But what would you say, give me two or three places in the world right now that you think are, I should say, like hotbeds of revolutionary action? I know it may not be one of them, but I know that there's a lot of fighting in the Philippines going on right now. So, I mean, it's not well known maybe, but there's fighting around the world. But revolutionary fighting, where do you think the hot spots are?
That's a good question because, again, we have to rethink our notions of what revolution is. If it's, you know, if we reduce it to armed struggle, then you're right. It's largely unknown. In the Philippines, for instance, which it's a good example, you have both Muslim guerrillas as well as Marxists, the New People's Army, both fighting against the Filipino government. Although they're not as heavily involved as they were, say, a decade or so ago, but it's still there. But obviously, the fulcrum of revolution in the United States, the fulcrum of revolution in the world is in the Middle East. So in Egypt, in Syria, in Palestine, nearby areas, it is Libya. But if we're talking about right now, this is the one part of the world where I would say there's the most potential for revolutionary change.
Is where?
In the Middle East.
In the Middle East, yeah. Well, that's right. I keep track of that. And I personally, I don't know how the Palestinians have managed to not make more of an uproar. I mean, most of them are at the place where they just want peace. People in Gaza want to be left alone, and they'd like to be able to travel to the rest of their country. You know, it's so... Yeah, that still is a very hot spot. Seems that Israel is above the international law or something. And the United States also seems to be from their actions. What do you think is going to come out of Syria? And is this just, I shouldn't say just, but is this one of the things that they're trying to do to get to Iran eventually?
Exactly. Again, you have, like, we started this conversation of talking about what starts out as reality becomes symbolism. That's what's happening in Syria. Syria, in a sense, is no longer relevant. What's relevant is Iran. When Obama threatened to strike at Syria, whether or not you believe there were chemical weapons used or not, it's irrelevant by this point. It was really meant to send a warning to the Iranians of, you know, don't you dare to try and build a nuclear bomb or we'll do this to you only tenfold. So exactly, it's essentially the U.S. you know, with junior partners such as Great Britain and France, trying to eliminate Iranian influence in the region. It's not about human rights. It's not about stopping chemical attacks. It's about the U.S. Seeing its best interest in, if not eliminating, which is now impossible, at the very least trying to strangle or put a stranglehold on the Iranian revolution.
Yeah. You know, that's it. It's never what it seems, just on the surface. The reasons are never what, well, just like when we went into Afghanistan. I mean, it was for the pipeline and et cetera, et cetera. It had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda.
No,
you know, that type of thing. And so I do think that people are becoming a bit more aware of that, that we're being told one thing to try to get us to go along with it, but it's not the real reason. And since we are becoming poorer and poorer in the United States, we're not very likely to be all excited over the truth, which is so somebody else can make a lot of money. Where do you think right now that there, whether it has been a quiet or overt operation, a revolution, where do you think it is pretty much working? I mean, a change has been implemented. What countries would
right.
you say?
Right. Without passing judgments on this or that regime, you know, positive or negative, red light or green light, what you're seeing, for instance, in Venezuela is a very positive change in the sense of
yeah.
making revolution by stages from
yeah.
mostly, although not entirely, bloodlessly. But I see it as a very exciting development. You know, the late Hugo Chavez talked about reinventing socialism for the 21st
yes.
century.
Yeah.
And I see that happening there. I'm not uncritical of the regime there. But at the
That's
same
true.
Time, I do see them, you know, adapting to a new reality where there's no Soviet Union. There are no strong communist parties in the Western world anymore, except for isolated places here and there. That would be an example of, shall we say, a revolution in slow motion. It is revolutionary, but it isn't like Castro in Cuba, you know, changing things almost literally overnight.
Right.
That would be one example.
Yeah. So that's true. I mean, Venezuela isn't perfect, but President Chavez really got things working. And he has a lot of admirers around the world.
Oh yeah,
so, you know he refused to be dependent on the United States, and because of that, the United States did everything they could to bring him down. And
yep.
then this election, you know, they were talking about how our alphabet agencies seem to be everywhere, Julio, and you know. to stir up things, and fortunately it didn't work like they planned. But I think, do you think that the, you know, I say alphabet agencies because I'm not meaning just the CIA, but there's several of the, what they call them, like black ops or something, that work in Latin
right.
America, they're still there, don't you believe, in the different countries?
Oh, yes, of course, it's never gone away. Like you said, some of it has been privatized, turned over to, you know, private agents, including not just mercenaries, but even, say, church organizations. So they are active in places such as Venezuela, you know, and Ecuador, Bolivia, and so on, trying to undermine these regimes. But no, the CIA, NSA, and as you say, alphabet soup agencies never really went away. They changed their names, they changed their tactics.
Yeah.
It would be harder to get away with a coup d'etat like that against Allende these days, but it wouldn't be impossible. The U.S. just simply has to use, you know, shall we say, subtler but no less deadly means to get rid of regimes in Latin America that doesn't care for. And it has done that in Honduras and Paraguay. There were fairly progressive regimes that were simply given the boot with the U.S. ambassador giving the green light to it. So we haven't, in that regard, left behind the, you know, the bad old days entirely. If there isn't a more U.S.-backed repression, it's because, you know, the kind of revolutions that are going on are seen, again, as we talked about before, as not so much anti-capitalist and anti-American so much as they are trying to reform their systems. But if the U.S. ever saw something like, you know, another Cuba or another Hugo Chavez pop up here and there in Latin America, I'm pretty sure it would do the same thing. You know, again, we have to do something transnational here. If you look at, without going into an analysis, if you look at what happened to Gaddafi, if you look at what he was trying to do with Assad, now that I'm on their side, but you see a very similar pattern of, you know, the U.S.
Yes.
essentially removing regimes it doesn't like through the United Nations, through NATO, Latin America. You know, again, that's not necessary because it's considered the U.S.'s backyard. But it's the same. The logic of empires works the same everywhere. Tactics are different, but the goal is not the U.S. has to be in control or else.
Yes. Yeah, no, I agree. We just have a couple minutes left. What would you say, just to wrap this particular talk up, because I want to have you back. You're very knowledgeable about this. What should we be on the lookout here in the U.S.? Because we know that things are changing, and we know people are becoming more aware. So what should those of us who want to further this revolutionary spirit, I would say, what should we be doing?
Okay, good question. I'm glad we're ending on that note. The first thing you need to do, obviously, is you mentioned it and I mentioned it too, is independence. You know, don't count on saviors to do this for you. And above all, don't fall into the trap of thinking that either the Democrats or the Republicans are going to change anything, because they're not.
Right.
Any decision they take is going to make things worse, especially on foreign policy. So if I had to focus in on one thing, it would be that political independence. It's lonely. It can be very depressing work at times, you know, politically as well as personally. But you have to talk to as many people as you can and say, you know, bottom line, you know, there's just one party in the United States that looks after the interests of the U.S. And even in the United States itself, it looks after the interests of the 1%. Let's not do that anymore. Let's not choose among, you know, slave masters, as Malcolm X would say, but instead focus on building up independent political activity. Even if you have to begin at the local level, you probably do, you know, in your city, in your town, and save the state for later or the nation for later. That's still better than just, you know, marching into the voting booth every 2 years or every 4 years and voting for the Democrats because the other side is so much worse. No. And the second thing obviously goes along with the first is start to think systematically, as opposed to this or that evil politician or this or that, you know, bad law, whether it be, you know, healthcare or immigration reform. No, you know, an empire comes in a package. You don't get to pick and choose which size you like, which portion you like and you don't like. So if people started thinking along the lines of, you know, we can't just focus on this or that reform, we have to focus on changing the entire thing. Unfortunately, it's understandable, but America, given that it is, you know, in pluribus unum, is also a very parochial place. You know, each group is looking after its own interests, be it, you know, this or that ethnic group or this or that political faction. So we need independence, first of all. We need action, second of all, and we need unity, third of all. I'm not saying I have a program for that, but at least I know what I don't want, which is what's there right now. And the first thing I have to do to get away from that is to just, you know, turn your back on what you don't want.
Okay. So it would be political independence, the action, and unity. Those are the three. Julio, we've got to go. I want to thank you so much. Julio Pino on Facebook, JULIOPINO. And I want to wish you a very happy equinox, my friend.
You too, and all of your listeners. Love and peace.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay.